I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli. I write for The New York Times, The New Yorker, and The Village Voice.
I'm Terry Teachout, drama critic of The Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the 12th episode of Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York about theater in America. We're hosted by American Theater Magazine, a publication of the Theater Communications Group.
And I know we've said that in the past, but today is a very special podcast because today it's Two on the Isle. Our friend and colleague Peter Marks was called to be on deck for the Tony nominations, which happened the morning we were taping the show. And so he was not able to make it. But you can, of course, read his take on the nominations in the Washington Post. But we lost one, but we gained one because we're very fortunate to have a great guest with us today. And that is Lynn Nottage, whose new play, Malima's Tale, is at the Public, and it's been extended until June 3rd. So you have some time to see it. It's a wonderful, wonderful play. I really liked it a lot.
And by one of our most gifted playwrights in America, I think.
Two-time Pulitzer winner for Ruined and Sweat, which also marked Lynn's Broadway debut. We will talk about all that with her later on. And so it's going to be a pretty special Two on the Isle today, as Terry and I hold down the fort.
I think we can manage, Elizabeth.
In fact, Peter should be a little wary, because if this goes a little too well, there could be trouble in paradise.
Well, Lynn, we're so glad you're here. Thank you for being
yes,
here.
Yes, hello.
It's a real pleasure to welcome Lynn Nottage in our luxurious studio. And as I mentioned earlier, Lynn's new play, directed by Joe Bonney, is currently at the Public Theater. It was extended once or twice, I think. And it's called Malima's Tale. And it tracks the journey of the tusks of an elephant named Malima. And Malima is played by Sarun Gorja. I hope I didn't butcher his name. So the show starts with the elephant's death in Kenya and takes us all the way to where the tusks end, which is as a statement piece, a carved art in a Beijing condo. And that takes us about 85 minutes
yes.
for this globetrotting adventure.
Actually, 75.
75. It's so economical. So we're very far in terms of style and content from Sweat, with which Lynn made, I think it was your Broadway debut last season.
Yes, that's true.
It just kind of blows my mind to say that.
It seems so impossible that you should just now be making your Broadway debut that I can't take it in, you know.
And Sweat, of course, was a naturalistic show set in a working-class bar in a working-class Pennsylvania town. And before that, I mean, there were many others, but among Lynn's other shows, you know, of course, there are Ruined, Crumbs from the Table of Joy, Intimate Apparel, Fabulation or The Eradication of Undine, and by the way, Meet Vera Stark, which is one of my personal favorites. We'll get back to that. So I guess we should start with a new show,
sure.
which is completely, and also I should mention also that the production is very stylized.
Yes.
So completely different in every possible way.
Yes.
In form and content from Sweat. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came about?
Sure. I think when I began having a conversation with director Joe Bonney, we wanted to do something that was unabashedly theatrical. We wanted to do something that really allowed the story to dictate the form. And the play is told from the point of view of an elephant. So right there, we have a magical element. And so we felt as though the form had to follow the magic that we were going to conjure.
And not just that, but the elephant is, I mean, I'm not spoiling anything here, but the elephant is killed at the beginning.
Right, he's killed within the first 5 minutes of the play, and it's a ghost story.
Mm-hmm. And there's...
Have you ever written anything like that before, Lynn?
I've never written anything from the point of view of an animal. I will say that this is brand new for me, and I don't think that I've written anything this short.
But you know, it's actually... I've got to say it's a really rare case where the show ended, and I thought, I wish this had been longer. Did you toy with that?
We didn't. I felt as though it was a perfect length. It was enough time to tell the story that we wanted to tell. And just in terms of creating this piece, I think it was made in a very unique way and absolutely different from how I generally make theater. And it comes out of an experience that I had this past summer in Reading, Pennsylvania, in which it was purely collaborative. Generally, off-Broadway, when you make a piece of theater, you meet the designers at the beginning of the process. They go away, you rehearse for 3 to 4 weeks, and then they come in for tech. But we decided that we wanted the designers and everyone really to be in the room with us as we were making it. And I think that what you see really reflects the fact that it was a pure collaboration as opposed to the elements being put together piecemeal.
Right.
Did you find that particularly exciting? I mean, for me, now that I've started to write for the stage, it is the collaborative aspect, particularly working with designers, that I find most fascinating and exciting.
I loved it because we could make changes in the moment, and I could turn to the costume designer and say to her, do you think we can do this? And she's like, let's try. And there's an element in the play, and I don't want to spoil it, but there's this sort of magical moment that we discovered while we were experimenting of how to take the elephant tusk through from when the elephant's killed to the house in Beijing.
Right.
And I don't think we could have found that element if we hadn't had the costume designer there working with us to figure out what the vocabulary was going to be.
Yeah, the most exciting and illuminating thing that a designer ever said to me was, don't try to be practical. Don't second guess us. We love challenges. You write it and we'll make it happen.
True, but I think so often when you're working with designers and you only have the tech time to do that experimentation, sometimes you're really stuck. And I felt really freed up by the fact that we could conjure and explore and experiment throughout the process rather than waiting for the last 4 days of rehearsal to do it.
Did you feel there's the production is really striking in terms of the technical aspect of it? Like there's a live score, it's done right there,
right?
As which actually I had not noticed him at first because I was like, he was a little bit behind the pillar from where I was sitting, and I was like, this score is great. Where is? And then I realized it was happening right there, and the lighting is also incredibly very stark.
Yes,
there's pretty much blocks of light that kind of form the stage.
Who's the lighting designer?
It's Lap Chi Chu.
Mm-hmm. And okay, I'm blanking out on the sound designer right now.
Like, Justin Hicks created the music. He's the sound of the elephant. And the sound designer is Darren West. And it really was a collaboration between the two of them. Justin was in the room with us the entire time, experimenting with the elephant sounds and creating sounds in the moment.
Right. So can we backtrack a little bit? Because you said that when you were talking with the director Joe Bonney, you did not have a play. It was really
no,
just
I had the
desire
play.
To. Oh, you did
no,
have the play.
Was absolutely finished.
Oh,
and
I see. Okay,
and I had a sense of what I wanted to do. And I have to backtrack because originally I had developed this play with director Catherine Bigelow.
Oh, wow! Okay,
wow.
And we had worked on it for a couple of years
for the stage.
For the stage.
Wow. Okay.
She was really interested in telling the story of elephant poaching, and felt that the stage might be the most interesting way to explore it because of the way in which you can get inside of an elephant's head.
That's really wild because she feels so like 100% cinematic to me. And do you know if she had done theater before?
She'd never done theater before.
Oh, wow. Okay. I'm so sorry, I'm completely speechless.
Did she see work of yours and decide this would be fun?
She had seen work. She had seen Sweat and had come to me and said, would you be interested in collaborating on this idea? And I thought, yeah, great. Had she seen Sweat? Maybe it was before Sweat. Maybe, yeah.
Wow. So you went
actually,
out on
I think it was before Sweat. Mm-hmm. Because I think we began in 2014 working on it.
Did she have any ideas on how, in her head, like what direction visually she wanted to go in?
Yeah, I think absolutely, because she's a filmmaker and mm-hmm. she thinks in pictures. And so right. I think that that's the place where she started, is she very much had a sense of what she saw on the stage, which is very different because I always begin with language mm-hmm. right. and sound.
But the show also seems to have like one of your trademark. It feels very researched. Without the research overwhelming the story, if you see what I mean. Yes. Like it felt like clearly you investigated. There's a Definitely. Kind of thriller aspect, documentary thriller aspect to it. Is that part of your MO in general, this kind of...
Well, what I always describe is that research for me is a form of procrastination, so that I can feel I can feel like I'm actually doing work without actually writing.
Right.
And so when it takes years for me, when I'm doing years of research, what I'm actually doing is years of a sort of creative procrastination.
Mm-hmm.
And so I enjoy the process. I love going outside of my comfort zone and discovering new places. I just think I have this very nomadic imagination, mm-hmm. and research becomes a way for me to travel without leaving.
Right. Do you tend to, because you have like a lot on your plate, do you tend to focus on one show at a time, or do you have several, like,
yeah, I'm
various back
two
burners?
Turntables. Yeah, that's how I work. And usually I'm usually working on a piece that tends to be very funny and a piece that tends to mm-hmm. be very serious. So for Sweat, for instance, I have Sweat. And then I have a companion piece called Floyd, which also takes place in Reading, which is a comedy and really different in tone and texture.
Not in a diner.
It's not in a diner.
We had that Twitter
exchange. It's not a diner. It's actually a sandwich shop.
This is very important. It is not a diner. It's a sandwich shop.
It is a sandwich shop.
So how is that a companion piece to
Well, there's one character from Sweat who enters into that world, and it's sort of marginally, it's sort of tangentially related to Sweat, mm-hmm. in that it's the same region of the country, but very different in tone and texture.
And that's going to be at the Guthrie.
That's going to be at the Guthrie next season, summer 2019.
Okay.
I'd like to ask you a related question to all this, Lynn. Do you think it would be fair to say that your work tends to be, how shall I put this, topic-driven, issue-driven, rather than just emerging from a bunch of characters who come to you? Tell us about the thought process, if you would.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think that perhaps the plays that are most popular are the ones that are topical, but I don't think it's true of all of the work. I think that Floyd is somewhat of a departure in that it really is character-driven, and it's a much more intimate piece. Sweat definitely was topical. Ruined was topical. I would say that even Vera Stark and Malima's Tale were topical. But in the case of Vera Stark, it very much was driven by a character, is that I was interested in a real-life woman
mm-hmm.
Named Teresa Harris, who was this beautiful ingenue and who was a wonderful actress, but you only found her in the margins of the screen because she was African-American. And so Vera Stark was really imagining what her journey would have been behind the scenes.
Tell me this. What comes first? I know for me what comes first is the stage picture and often the first line. What turns on the lights in your head and tells you that there's a play there?
Well, I usually come up with an image that I build the play around. So, for instance, in Ruined, the image that I used that became the central metaphor for the play in Ruined is about rape in the Congo, and really about a madam who at once exploits and protects women. And so the image that I used to build that play was of a mother who has a hut that's in the very top of a hill, and in the distance she can see soldiers slowly marching towards her hut and up the hill, and she knows that her daughter is the most beautiful young woman in the village, and inevitably they'll come and take her. And she smashes a Coca-Cola bottle, and she destroys her daughter's face. And in that moment, she has destroyed her face, but she saved her life. And so that is the central metaphor and image that I used for Ruin. And for a play like intimate apparel, the image that I used is of Esther, who is a seamstress who feels bound to her sewing machine. And so for me, the sewing machine became the central image. And the way in which I strung that play together is I wanted her at the very beginning of that play to sit down at the sewing machine, and it was a symbol of oppression. And when she sits down at the sewing machine at the end, it's a symbol of her liberation. And so that's the image that I built the play around.
At what point do you start to, so to speak, fill these images with words?
It depends on the piece. With Intimate Apparel, I think I began immediately. And for that play, which was unusual, is that I wrote the first and last scene, and I didn't change a word. So that came very quickly. And then I filled in the rest of the play over the course of time. And Ruined took a little longer just because of the foreign landscape. And I felt as because it was a topic that wasn't as familiar to an American audience, that I felt as though I needed to do much more research. And I felt more protective of the women. Mm-hmm. Again, it's interesting to hear that you begin with an image as well.
It right from the beginning, when I first wrote an opera libretto, the first thing I saw was at rise, what happens when the lights go up? Or actually, it was, what do you hear? You heard gunshots. And everything flowed out of that, but it was entirely, it was not verbal. And for somebody who's just been that kind of writer all his life, it really surprised me. I never thought of myself as thinking in terms of images.
I find that for me, it's very helpful. And I teach, and a lot of times when the students are stuck, I ask them to find an image that summarizes the essence of their story. And that could be their organizing principle.
So you teach at Columbia, right? What kind of class do you teach?
I do two classes. I have one class which is called American Spectacle, looking at theater outside of the proscenium, and it's really looking to theatrical forms outside of traditional theater for structural inspiration.
Oh, what?
We always begin the very first class by going to the Coney Island Sideshow and looking at the structure of the sideshow, which is a 10-in-1. In which you have mm-hmm. 10 discrete acts that mm-hmm. become one cohesive show, but are interchangeable, okay. And that you can enter the show at any point. And so that's where we begin.
Okay.
What a wonderful idea for an opening class.
And so we spend a year journeying to many different theatrical experiences. One of the ones that we did most recently, which was really surprisingly fun, and I think it was their favorite, we actually went to see semi-professional wrestling in Queens.
Oh, whoa.
And it was 4 hours, and it didn't feel like that. And the kids were absolutely 100% entranced by it, because it had uh-huh. all the elements of good theater and melodrama. And it was very sort of economical storytelling, and it was exciting.
So it's
you're reminding me of my favorite song about theater. That's entertainment.
Yes, it was very much entertainment. Yes.
So the idea is basically to find storytelling, different storytelling modes in places where you may not necessarily expect them, and then helping them, and maybe yourself too, like bring them into a theatrical form.
Yeah, absolutely. It's also, I think, for me, it's a response to the Academy defining theater in a very narrow way. Mm-hmm. And the majority of Americans actually engage with theater, and it's quite popular, but it's not in the spaces that we tend to think. And the other reason why I do the class is I think that our stories have been limited by the theaters that have been built.
Oh, you mean like in terms of the sheer physical space?
Sheer physical mm-hmm. spaces is that you have all of these regional theaters and off-Broadway theaters that have been built, and they demand that we as theater artists create work for those spaces. And sometimes our imaginations are more expansive. Mm-hmm. And so I'm hopefully creating sort of a generation of theater artists who are thinking more expansively
right.
about where and how and what theater is.
There seems to be some of the newer theaters seem to be a little bit more flexible in
yeah.
terms of where you can sit the audience. I mean, that's just a start, but and I think
well,
there's
I think
also
they have to be because
right.
I think that the artists are growing faster than the spaces.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
I once saw a Lear in Boston. It was done by Actor Shakespeare project, which moves into different kinds of spaces. And it was performed in a theater that had originally been an automobile dealership showroom. Obviously, there was no window, but otherwise the physical space was radically different. And I'd never seen anything like this. This was quite early in my career as a drama critic. And it really just seemed to break up my idea of where theater happens and what it should look like. And that was a formative experience for me.
Yeah, I think you're completely right also about what you say about people experience theater in America in places that we don't necessarily think about. Like, I'm completely fascinated, for instance, by all the theater people experience on cruise ships.
Right.
Which is a huge market.
Which is tens of thousands of people.
Mm-hmm. I mean, usually they do musicals, but hey, you know, it's all good.
Because some of the places that we go, we also visit mega churches.
Oh, yes.
And there's one mega church that we go in particular in, which has a very young congregation that's incredibly multicultural, and they do something like 6 or 7 quote-unquote shows a day, and each has about 1,000 people. And I thought, why aren't these people coming into traditional theater spaces? But they will go there, mm-hmm. and yeah.
I've seen two productions of Doubt and reviewed them that were both performed in churches, in actual sanctuaries. One was a working church. The other, in Cape May, New Jersey, was a church that had been turned into a full-time theater, but the physical space was not different. And boy, did that condition the atmosphere in which you received a play on this subject matter.
I'm sure that's absolutely true. It probably transforms the way in which you receive the play.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very much so. And two of the very best revivals of Doubt that I've ever seen, I think not coincidentally at all.
You know, we're taking Sweat on the road in the fall through the Rust Belt, and we're going to go completely in non-traditional theater spaces and into cities that don't have regional theaters. And we have to adapt it to places in which we're not going to have lighting, in which we're going to do it in 3/4 round. It's going to be gymnasiums and mason halls and auditoriums.
Yeah, En Garde. Do you remember En Garde? They used to do very. I remember seeing a stage version of They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Which, I mean, was inspired by that. It was actually called something else. Did you work? And it was done at the Masonic Hall on 23rd Street. Oh, what was it called? It was not called that. Anyway, it was about dance marathons of the 30s.
Which is, yeah, that's what...
Right.
That's the...
Right. This leads us... I'm sorry, go on.
Oh, actually, yeah, I was going to ask you because you're going to be a writer in residence at the Signature Theater, the one in New York, next season. And they do have one flexible space out of their 3 venues, I think, where I've seen... Every time I've been in that one, I can't remember the title of that particular... One of their 3.
I think we're going to be... I'm not sure whether we're going to be in the flexible stage or not. I can't remember.
So it's an interesting... the writer-in-residence program is an interesting one because so you're going to do 2 plays, two older plays. You're going to do, by the way, Meet Vera Stark and...
Fabulation.
And Fabulation. Are you planning to tweak them process?
We'll see. I think for, by the way, Meet Vera Stark, there are things that I wanted to definitely do. And I tweaked it from when it was in New York and I still want to tamper with it a little bit. Cause what I realize, and this may not ultimately come to pass, but I think it's a play in 3 acts.
Oh,
and
okay.
So I may do that.
Wow. It feels so balanced to me.
It feels
because
balanced, but I think it's... I'm playing with what happens if I break it into 3 parts as opposed to 2 parts. But that's one of the conversations. And for Fabulation, I don't know that I'm going to do a lot of tampering.
Mm-hmm. And the third production will be a new play.
Yes.
So I guess we can't... Don't know.
I don't know.
Big mystery, big question mark. So, Terry, did you have something? Did you have another question?
We were talking about spaces. We were talking about Sweat. And Of course, sweat has now been done in, I guess, what you might call the least flexible of stages, Broadway theater. And this is a major development for you to make your Broadway debut. We in the theater world, of course, we've all known about Lynn Nottage for a long time. But I can't help but think that this must have introduced you to a new audience. Is that your impression? And how do you feel about that? How did having the play done on Broadway affect you?
You know, it's interesting. I don't know yet what the impact will be, because we didn't do another production of Sweat yet since Broadway. So I don't know how to answer that question. And I'm fearful that being on Broadway last year ruined it for women, because I was looking at the season and I thought, wow, there are no new plays written by people of color on Broadway. And I think there was only one play written by a woman that made an appearance.
You mean this season?
This season.
Oh, this season is a horror. Yeah, this season is a horror in every single way you can think of.
So you asked me what the impact is, and I'm not sure, because it feels almost as though it didn't happen.
Ah, that's really interesting. And more and more, as we've said on this broadcast before, I feel as though the real action, the creative action in theater it's been a long time since it's been happening on Broadway. We don't look to Broadway for new developments, exciting developments. It's just this place, this kind of isolated place where stuff happens whose relevance to the larger world of theater is I think, very modest. Sounds like that's what you're feeling as well.
Yes, but yes. I will say something, though. Until we figure out how to make Off-Broadway economically viable so people can make a living on it, it's very hard to make a living off-Broadway for playwright, for director, for actors. Broadway means like a certain economic freedom that can then free you up to do other thing and not be concerned about paying the rent. So if only for that. So until we find, you know, that elusive off-Broadway model where people can get paid what they're worth and not, I mean, I think last year, a couple of years ago, there were all these stories of actors who were quitting acting because they just
can't make a living.
Survive.
Well, you know, I mean, what's interesting about Broadway is that it's an amplifier and it sends work into regional theaters. And I do think that Sweat will have a regional life because it had a Broadway life. And I'm really thankful about that, but we have to figure out other ways in which we can amplify the work so it can take the journey around the country, because we most of us cannot make a living doing off-Broadway theater in New York. That's not how we survive.
Mm-hmm.
How do you survive? We've asked other people this, and let's just ask you flat out. I mean, where does the income come from for a playwright?
Well, I have to say, people... people always joke because I say that I work like an immigrant. Is that I pull together my living from many different sources, and I feel like I work 7 days a week. But I teach, and I teach full time, which is my steady source of income, and I'm very thankful for it because I love teaching, and it allows me to exercise my theater muscles and make a living. I've dabbled in television.
Oh yes, you worked She's Got a Habit. How was that experience? Because so many playwrights are turning to television.
I really loved the experience. One, because it got me outside of my house, and I got to sit in the room with other people and have conversation. I'm so used to spending all my time by myself. Navel gazing. And so this allowed me, when I got stuck with an idea, to turn to someone else and say, what do you think? How would you solve that problem? And someone immediately had an idea, and I found that to be refreshing.
Mm-hmm. Was there something constricting or freeing about working with characters that were not yours in a way?
I kind of loved it because I didn't feel the same sort of responsibility, because I thought ultimately I'm invested in the story, but this is not my story. Mm-hmm. I'm just here to support the vision of Spike Lee and help him tell the story that he wanted to tell. In some ways, I felt I didn't have to be the lead artist. And after being the lead artist for so long, sometimes you just want to sit back.
I have found I've started to direct now, and I find that's incredibly stimulating and exciting to me. And I wonder, is it something that you've done or thought of doing or know you don't want to do?
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
Yeah, you know what? I don't think that I have the constitution to be a director. It requires a certain kind of patience and executive function that I don't necessarily have. I love collaborating with directors, but I don't have that muscle.
We were talking about teaching just a moment ago. Does that stimulate your creative muscle as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I look at my classes as ways to investigate questions and problems that I have. And so I feel that I'm always active creatively when I'm sitting in the classroom. And I also love engaging with younger playwrights and seeing how they wrestle with ideas and how they're in conversation with the world. And most recently, I was in playwriting class and the playwrights were talking about something. And I thought, I have no idea what they're talking about. I'm going to have to like, go on Google and figure it out. And I found that to be really exciting.
Mm-hmm. Is it draining too, though? I mean, that part of it seems inescapable. It's a trade-off. I mean, everything we do is a trade-off, but it strikes me that maybe that's where the trade-off is, that you're giving the juices that might otherwise go into creative work.
You know, I feel like it's an exchange of energy, and I surprisingly always look forward to going into the classroom. It's the place where I go to relax.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. That's really exciting.
I enjoy it. I actually look forward every Friday because I thought I'm going to hear new work. I can sit back and enjoy people wrestling with new ideas.
Now, I'm fascinated. I love teaching. I never get to do enough of it. But it's not in any way relaxing to me. It's as though I'm giving a performance or taking part in a performance. And after a session is done, I feel completely washed out.
You know,
not in a bad way, but washed out.
I think it depends on the class you teach. I taught one class years ago, which was a lecture class, which gave me so much stress the whole week before. And I thought, I will never do this again, because each week I had to prepare an hour and a half worth of material, and 14 weeks, that's a lot of work.
And that's also more performative.
That's more performative. And what I'm doing is less, it's a workshop. You know, it's an exchange of ideas. We're reading work. We're doing feedback. We're talking. And we spend a lot of time actually talking about theater we've seen or theater we want to see and what's exciting to us and ideas.
Mm-hmm. What's been exciting to you? What have you seen lately that has spoken to you?
I most recently, because I've been seeing a lot of my student work, have seen a few plays which I thought, this is really quite wonderful. Because these are students who I met 3 years ago and I've helped nurture them, and to see where they've landed, I find to be incredibly, you talk about stimulating, to be incredibly stimulating. And I thought some of the work was excellent. And I thought these are going to be playwrights who are going to have an impact. And
So you track them once they've left the cocoon of the university.
But
you've been teaching long enough to start seeing the arcs of growing careers, haven't
growing
you?
Careers. And I saw most recently, because I've been seeing mostly student work, I saw St. Joan, but I felt like it was seeing my students' work, because I gave Condola Rashad her first job, her first professional job in Ruined,
right,
and at Manhattan Theater Club.
Right.
And so it just was so exciting to see how she's evolved as an actress and how now she's become this commanding presence on the stage.
Oh yeah, that's I was just going to say, like, that's just lovely to be able to track that over years.
They're like children, aren't they?
They are like children.
Yeah, that's how wonderful.
All right. Well, I think we should, sadly, we should wrap this up. for today, and I'm so bummed for Peter that he missed this.
It's what a wonderful pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you.
We congratulate you on the success of Lima's Tale.
Thank you.
Naturally, we all look forward to whatever comes next for you.
I am so looking forward to the signature season and to Floyd's, which means that which is not set in a diner, but we'll be at the Guthrie next season.
Thanks for spending time with us. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you. All right, take care.
Well, we made it. It's always great when you have someone like Lynn Nottage. I feel so lucky to be able to have a conversation with. She's one of America's most vibrant, smart, just warm. She's such an amazing playwright and a terrific person to boot. So it's. I feel like I'm gushing, but I really I am. I'm a total.
No, I feel the same way. And somebody I've always wanted to meet.
She's great, and I really feel her students are so lucky to be learning with her. So I think that's it for today. As usual, I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli,
and I'm Terry Teachout. You have been listening to Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York about theater in America, hosted by American Theater Magazine.
Our producer is Kirby Pate. You can follow us on Twitter at Three on the Isle and write to us at threeontheisle@gmail.com. Both times are spelled out. And make sure you leave us a rating, a really great rating, and an amazing, 7 stars out of 5, and a glowing review on iTunes or Google Play or wherever you get your podcast from.
And thanks for listening. We will see you next time on the Isle.